Please stand by. Good day. Welcome to the IBM Storage Talk, Preparing Your Customers' Environments for TSM 6 Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Ms. Tricia G. Young. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you. Welcome, everybody. Today, we're excited to have Brandon Moore, who is a consultant IT specialist, who is the Tivoli Storage Tech Leader for Americas with the outsourcing accounts. And he's going to be walking us through this presentation that he put together based upon his experience during the beta program with TSM6. It is a two-hour call. We will take questions in the middle and once again at the end. We are recording this call, so if you do have colleagues who'd like to hear it or if you'd like to hear it again, we will have the replay posted out on the IBM Tivoli Talk site as well as on the Partner World site. In addition, the technical enablement team is doing a whole series of Tivoli Talks, storage talks, so keep an eye out for the alerts that will be coming out. Next week, about the same time, we will be doing a subcapacity pricing call for TSM6, and then after that, next few weeks, we will have the TSM developers on for kind of a chalk talk where you can call in and ask them different questions about the TSM6 products and some of the new functions. We also have a roadshow going on, so please be looking for the roadshow coming to a city near you. We're covering worldwide over 46 cities. And once again, you can find information on that in the storage alerts that our team sends out. If for some reason you do not have today's presentation, you can send me an email. My email is Tricia, T-R-I-C-I-A, at us.ibm.com, and I'll get that presentation to you. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Brandon.
Thank you so much, Tricia. Good morning, good afternoon, and good tomorrow for those of you who might be on tomorrow already. My name is Brandon Moore, and today I wanted to just talk to you about how you can look at different ways of preparing your customer's environment for the next version of TSM6. First thing, as we progress to slide 2, we have an agenda for the day. First part of the agenda talks about an introduction of me and my background and why I think this presentation is important, the challenge around preparing your customers' environments for TSM6, looking at some background information where we'll get into a lot of things that may or may not have been considered initially, and sometimes we, depending on our background and whether we're a software IT specialist or a hardware IT specialist, don't necessarily get into. And so with that background, there'll be issues dealing with your operating systems that the various TSM platforms run on, as well as subsystems. Within those subsystems, there are several categories, including the disk, as well as network. We'll talk specifically about TSM. We'll have our break at that point concerning questions, and then we're going to go into server hardware review. And a part of what that will be is an excerpt from a presentation that I gave about 2 years ago at Software University 2006, where we started looking at melding these two worlds together of how, within Tivoli Storage, software and hardware are an integral part of making the solution successful. And so the result of that presentation allowed me to develop what I call TSM server reference platforms for hardware, which will be the next part. And then at the very end, we'll have some cute pictures, some other pieces of nifty information, and more time for questions. I'm not expecting that we'll take 2 hours for the entire presentation. I'm hoping that we'll be able to get into some of your questions and provide some insight. As well, there'll be subsequent ways of communicating this information that will be developed and hopefully be able to take what you've contributed here as well as what could be contributed later and putting it together in some type of online forum. So with that, we'll move to slide 3. Starts with my introduction and just give you a background of my experience and how I came into information technology. And so in 91, it all started with me on a System 5 Unix box, and here I am today giving you a presentation concerning Tivoli Storage Manager. And so I've worked in academia, high-performance computing at Florida A&M and Florida State University. Through that, moved into corporate America with EDS, working for the GM account, and I've basically been a customer, an academic, a consultant, a contractor, and now in my current role, I serve as a sales leader or a storage business development leader for the outsourced accounts within the Americas. And typically what I do there is we talk about the value propositions associated with software, but there are times where I have to put my consulting IT specialist hat on and get very technical. So I'll warn you right now, we are going to be in the weeds, and we probably won't talk very much about TSM specifically, but I think that you'll appreciate the level at which we'll be discussing things. So as we move to slide 4, we continue the introduction, and we just want to repeat the email that was sent in the flash, just that this is a storage talk that will focus your customers on preparing their current TSM environment for an upgrade to TSM 6. And so we're going to look at things that, in terms of TSM, have not, maybe everyone just hasn't paid a whole lot of attention to, but when we consider that the back end of TSM 6 will be a real DB2 database, a lot of what's going to happen here is a lot of best practices that have been old hat within the RDBMS world are going to apply to TSM. I've been working with a lot of these best practices and proven practices for some time in anticipation of finally having DB2 being the back end for TSM 6. Now that time is here. We'll also cover suggestions for hardware as well as land and sand considerations for TSM servers. And there's also, in fact, I've already had a couple of questions come in prior to this conversation, so what I'll try to do is make sure I get those answered as well during the question period. Slide 5 presents the challenge. From my experience, the most important piece of this transition to the next version of TSM is the database upgrade. And when we talk about the database upgrade, it's simply understanding that this upgrade is going to move only as fast as the source will allow it. And I want you to keep that in the back of your mind because that is what we're going to focus on throughout this presentation. I know you've seen various different times and estimations being given in several of the presentations that are going on about TSM 6. But what I'm trying to do here today is help you understand that those numbers are what they are, but there are ways that you can tailor and take that information and find out for your own with your individual customers, and that's what we're going to be showing you today. On slide 6, as we continue this challenge, understanding the physical layout of the TSM database below the file system is also key. And one of the things that we have to do is, again, considering that some of the things now that we're going to be looking at in TSM were always considered to be proven practice within database. And again, this presentation is to help design you to consider these ideas. It's not a catch-all, but it's something to give you to think about. And I will say this now, and I'll repeat it a bunch of times throughout the presentation. You need to be working with your customers over the next 6 to 12 months to help them understand the transition that they're going to be making here. And I say 6 to 12 months because, again, we need time for the code to get out into the field. We need time for people to consider that if they've got 2, 3, and I know everyone doesn't have the 200 and 300 gig and 500 gig databases, but you're going to find that you're going to see more and more customers are getting and growing that large. In particular, when you think about some of the legal regulations that require companies to keep years and years of backup because of various different rules. So we'll talk about that as well. Moving to slide 7 brings us back to our agenda, and we'll now get into some background information around how do we address this challenge. So on slide 8, our background starts with, we'll start with a bit of a disk I.O. primer. And this starts at the very base level, stuff that we as software IT specialists don't always see, but if there are any hardware brethren on the phone, this is something they deal with all the time. We'll talk a bit about sequential versus random I.O. and the characteristics of such, caching versus no caching. This speaks specifically to not only what TSM does, but what happens in disk subsystems. And then the last part of background, we'll talk about RAID and how RAID can help you or hurt you in this scenario. On slide 9, we'll start with the disk I.O. primer. Now, one of the things we need to understand is that a single physical disk, regardless of its RPMs per second, or RPMs per second, whether it's 10,000 or 15,000. And right now, if you're building out any new environment, you're going to be hard-pressed to find any 10,000 RPM drives available. For the most part, they're capable of 100 to 200 IOPS per second. Right, random IOPS usually are lower, but those random IOPS usually require a drive that can speed, that can spin faster. Hence, you would typically use 15K drives for certain parts of your database. And depending on the DBA in your environment, they have or request 15K drives for everything. As opposed to sequential IOs, typically you're able to get closer to that 200 IOPS per second rate. Now, again, with the TSM database, it's important to know that it writes in 4K chunks, and it can, and those can be sent, those writes can be sent to the TSM database from the recovery log in as many as 64 chunks at a time. During backup, TSM database reads in 256K chunks. So it's important to understand how the database writes and how that's going to relate to how that data eventually gets written out to your back-end disk system. On slide 10, we look at sequential I/O versus random I/O. And what we wanted to do here is when we think about sequential I/O, how does that relate to the TSM database and recovery log? And so as we look at that, we see that the TSM recovery log is write-heavy, obviously, because that's where all the initial transactions for database initially enter. And then they're also committed to the database itself after a certain amount of time, or in the case of the roll forward mode, after you've done an incremental backup or a full backup when it commits all changes from the recovery log, as well as it being read heavy. Again, in order to move all that data and commit those changes to the database, heavy read IO. Excuse me. As far as the TSM database, from a sequential standpoint, the writing is light. There's not very much from a sequential standpoint, just doesn't write heavily. It's especially the same case for reading, not heavy sequential IO, except during backup, of course. On the flip side of this, when we look at slide 11, when we look at random IO, it's a lot different in the sense that for recovery logs, it's just the opposite, where it doesn't write as heavily or read as heavily from a random perspective, but in the TSM database, write heavy, read heavy. Now, normally what would happen is that, and this is one of the reasons why, and we'll talk about this later, but there's always been the old adage within TSM that you don't want to have your recovery logs and your databases on the same physical volume. And that still holds true today. Again, some of this stuff is obvious and it makes sense right off, but we want to make sure we cover all the bases here because you're going to need to be able to squeeze as much performance out of your customers, either existing, your customer's existing database as possible. And a little later on, we'll talk about just some other strategies of how to get more out of it without taking their system down forever. Slide 12, we talk about caching. And one of the ways that TSM database caches IOPS is with the TSM buffer pool. Now, that buffer pool isn't just for the database. It's for the application's use as well. But, again, it's how the TSM database is able to respond a little bit quicker to results for requests for information. With that database buffer pool cache, there's several different best practices associated with that. We're not going to go into them now. But I found that in some situations, making them larger than what's recommended does have some advantages, particularly when you get into much larger database sizes. We're talking about, say, 200 gig or more. The second point there just says 1 gigabyte or greater in terms of setting your TSM buff pool. Again, you can have it automatically adjust. I would suggest that you always set it some physical number so that you can make sure you reserve that physical piece of memory, because what happens during startup is that buff pool number is given to the TSM server process and it goes out and it actually claims a 1 gigabyte or more space of physical RAM for itself. And that's really important with a system like this to ensure that you get your piece of physical RAM assigned to this application. And then another part of caching, the RAID subsystems also perform caching. A lot of this is for quicker response for applications, akin to a lot of what the SVC does, but we'll talk a little later more in the subsystem section as to how that can be advantageous or not for you. When we look at no caching, there's the caching provided by the aforementioned SAN volume controller, or SVC, and then there's non-SVC virtualized storage as well that can perform caching. And the thing here to keep in mind is when you're using SVC, we'll touch on this again, but when you're using SVC, it's important to remember that that cache is shared. If you're sharing that SVC with another set of applications and TSM, there are special considerations you need to take. So slide 13, we talk about background for RAID. And we basically break this part out into three different sections. One, strips and stripes forever, RAID 0, 1, 5, and 10. And then we'll talk about what I call RAID TSM. Strips and stripes forever. The idea is that a certain amount of what we're talking about here is that on each physical disk, there's an amount of data that is physically written to a disk within a RAID array. And so that piece of data is called a data strip. On slide 15, the amount of data written to a strip is referred to the stripe depth. So really, when we talk about this, you're going to have a strip of data that's written on a physical disk to represent data that's written out. And one of the things that you want to try to do is you want to align that stripe depth with the block size from the host file system as well as the data I/O operation. At this point, the data I/O operation is how the TSM database itself reads or writes to a given file system or its database volumes. What we're essentially trying to do is make sure that when the TSM database issues a write in whatever size it happens to be, in the case of TSM, it's a 4K chunk, that if we're going to have a RAID array in the background, that we're maximizing our IOPS per second across the number of disks. So, for instance, if we were to have, say, an 8-disk RAID array for a TSM database, I know that's a bit extreme, but essentially you'd want to make sure that all 8 disks in that RAID array are writing for each particular IO that the TSM database issues so that you can get more IOPS per second from that RAID array from those disk volumes. Now, again, this for some of you, this all is making sense. For others, I mean, it may take a bit of understanding, but I think as we get through this presentation, we'll understand that. And, of course, we'll have questions as well. On slide 16, we talk about the different types of RAID and how they can help you. Again, RAID 0 is striping, no redundancy, and we talk about its read or write performance. RAID 1 is mirroring or redundancy, and I really wouldn't mirroring or redundancy. RAID 5 is fault tolerance, but yet the data is striped across the disk within the RAID set. And then we have RAID 10, where there's striping and redundancy. But, of course, with each of those, there are several penalties in terms of storage. Obviously, with RAID 10 being the most, having some of the best read-write performance, it does require twice as much disk as opposed to, say, a RAID 5 configuration. You would have a 20% overhead associated with your disk. Again, all basic RAID stuff, but we're making sure we go through this so we can have a base of understanding on how we can make TSM work better. Slide 17 talks about RAID TSM. I call it RAID TSM because essentially it's doing mirroring, which is RAID 1. And it's important, this type of mirroring, because it's at the application level. And in different parts of my experience, I've seen how hardware RAID can really affect the TSM server's performance. And, in fact, performance from the standpoint of whether it comes up or comes down or contributes to corruption. So we'll talk about how RAID TSM is a much better way to protect your TSM database, but then also improve performance. The thing about this is that you have multiple copies of your TSM volumes. TSM is an application that can detect, that will detect if there's discrepancies between two different copies and actually fix it. You run a risk by only having one copy of a volume running for TSM. And the risk is even greater when you are doing hardware-level mirroring or even logical volume mirroring, but we'll talk about that some more later. Slide 18. TSM also mirrors at the transaction level, and then subsequently that mirroring also translates to the hardware at the I/O level. And the thing to keep in mind is that the hardware will always mirror each I/O, but TSM will only mirror complete transactions, and that's the key here. Using hardware RAID is just not an option for the TSM database because of the potential for corruption. Slide 19. So essentially, RAID TSM performs RAID 1 operations, which is mirroring, with application-level intelligence. And so within that, you get some additional benefits that you wouldn't get from hardware RAID in the way of load balancing for read and write operations. Of course, you can always set whether you want parallel or sequential writes in the TSM op file. It gives you redundancy, but it also gives you something that if you ever wanted to try, you could always mirror across multiple subsystems so that it gives you an extra level of physical redundancy as well. And so when we talk about RAID TSM, it provides that intelligent mirroring you need, but it also, when combined with RAID 0, whether you do it at the operating system level or in the physical subsystem level, gives you basically the best of both worlds. In the sense that it gives you the best of both worlds in terms of performance. So in slide 20, again, I repeat the admonition relating to not using RAID 1 at the operating system or RAID controller level because there is a potential for data corruption. It's cheaper and better to do it with TSM, and there's just some really nasty things that can happen when you do mirroring at this particular level, which some of you I know may have experienced personally, as I have. Slide 21. So now we're on the agenda part where we talk about operating systems. And so within these operating systems, of course, we have everyone's favorite, but my personal favorite, AIX, next being Windows and Linux and then others. Slide 23. In looking at the operating systems, we will lump together AIX, Linux, and other Unixes in terms of understanding best practices around how and where you place the database. Now, there's been years of discussion about whether you use file systems for logical volumes or raw logical volumes. And so what I'm going to give you right now is based upon my experience and what I've seen to work. And what I will tell you is that there are the advantages to running file systems, particularly now that you have options within AIX to do direct IO and you bypass the file system caching that AIX as an operating system does, and hence you don't have to fool around with virtual memory tuning as much as you had to in the older days, gives you the protection of the file system and near raw logical volume performance. It also gives you several levels of flexibility at the operating system as well. I use raw logical volumes, not in production, but I use them during DR because it cuts down your recovery time significantly when you use raw logical volumes. I just came back from a DR exercise with a customer and going through using this new process. Again, we saved probably an hour to an hour and a half from having to, by using raw logical volumes instead of traditional file-based ones, we saved about an hour and a half worth of time formatting out the 130-gig database. The main reason why you do that at DR is that in some situations, unless, especially if you're going to SunGuard or somewhere where you have a DR test, lots of times you don't always have the exact same configuration at home. And so because of that, you just can't be sure the level of performance that you'll get. So for DR, biological volumes, in my opinion, are okay. I issue a caution about logical volume managers. You really need to understand how your various, how your logical volume managers work, how also the file systems and such work with those too. You want to make sure that you have the ability to align your I/O, your blocks, your physical partitions, have the ability to align that with how TSM is going to write to said logical volume, and then conversely how that logical volume will write to the physical volume itself. And the other thing that happens here is that you can decrease the amount of physical RAM used, and that's clearly a statement associated with an AIX and having within AIX and how if you mount your file systems that the database is sit on with the direct I/O option, and I'm aware that there's a direct I/O option as a function of TSM, but by doing this at the file system level, at the operating system level as well, what it does is that now AIX as an operating system won't reserve a large portion of the physical RAM to do file system caching. So again, some of you may want to have conversations with your AIX administrators or your Unix administrators, and this may be a good opportunity for you to kind of bone up on these things, but the idea here, we don't want to use, on our TSM systems, we want to make sure the RAM that is on that system is being used for TSM, for the data, for any other operations necessary to make that run as quickly as possible. When we look at Windows, again, file systems, yes. While logical volumes, I say no except during DR. It really just depends on what kind of setup you have. Some of you may be running Veritas Volume Manager out there. There may be different things that you're doing. But for the most part, the whole idea here is that if you can use raw partitions, it just makes the formatting process a whole lot easier doing DR. And then lastly, if you can get away with it, not using a Windows Logical Volume Manager, in part because there's just an extra amount of time, there's an extra level of headache and overhead associated with using logical volume managers with Windows. That's just what I found. For some of you, it may be different. Again, a lot of this is just giving you some things to think about. The last note on this presentation talks about filling the file systems. This is something I ran into, and this is just typical of the things that happens at the operating system that sometimes you may not be aware of. And you need to keep basically your file systems at less than 100%. Don't format your database volumes out to fill up the file system totally, because various different operating systems, if it experiences a bad block, you need some free space to do a couple of things. One, to be able to extend the file system with a logical volume, but also for bad block relocation. It's one of the reasons why you just have extra space. That's one of those things I've just run across in the past and wanted to pass that on to you. Slide 24. So AIX supports RAID 1, RAID 0, RAID 10, but RAID 0 is just not a good idea. And what happens is that there's potential for TSM database volume information to be overwritten. Hold on. Let me take that back. I would say that it's not a good idea at the logical volume level, because you can do it at the actual disk subsystem level. And by duplicating that at AIX, in my opinion, it's just redundant. There's no need to do that. If in AIX, the biggest thing you want to do is when those H disks that are already RAID zeroed from the hardware subsystem, essentially what you want to do is just make sure that make sure that the data is written across the logical volume as much as possible. What will happen is that as data is written to that logical volume, the hardware system will translate it properly in terms of laying it out in strips and stripes across those particular RAID arrays. RAID 1, again, here, RAID 1 and RAID 10 were just describing what they are in terms of AIX. The thing here is that the second point is we really just don't want to use AIX level mirroring because you have the potential to write over volume information at the TSM level.
Right.
And so, again, TSM knows what it's doing with its volumes, but it doesn't necessarily know how AIX is actually writing to those logical volumes as well. So it's important to really make things as simple as possible, and that's what I'm getting at here. There's no sense or need to add that additional layer of management from the LVM in the sense of allowing it to do some the software RAID sorts of things. Do all of that work at the hardware subsystem level, create simple logical volumes with your logical volume manager, place file systems in them, and then allow TSM to do the mirroring of those volumes. The whole idea is that you want to keep your logical volume configuration as simple as possible because it will help you in the long run. Again, the TSM server has to be the system that can be brought up the quickest given a DR scenario, but it also has to be the one that has the least amount of overhead. And the way you drive overhead out at the operating system level is making things as simple as possible. Slide 25. That looks like a duplicate, so I'm sorry about that. Moving on to slide 26, we have an additional agenda slide. And now we'll be talking about subsystems. Slide 27, we have three different subsystems that we'll discuss, fiber channel subsystems, Ethernet network attached subsystems, and then also virtualized. As we look at slide 28, this is, again, stuff that may or may not be common knowledge to most folks, but we want to make sure that we bring this out. This particular point, we'll revisit this a little later in the presentation when we talk more about hardware selection, but as a general point, your disk HBA ports, not cards, but ports, ratio should be in a ratio of 2 disk ports per 1 HBA, regardless of it being 2 gigabit, 4 gigabit, or 8 gigabit. Now, as we look at this, we're going to find that there's reasoning for this. Primarily, it's because by having this sort of ratio, it allows you to do a couple of things. It allows you some overhead when writing to disk for backups, and then if you have the need to either do concurrent writes to tape, or if you are doing migrations or migrations happen to occur during backup, or you happen to start your backup of your disk, your primary disk pools, the copy pools, during the backup window, this allows a couple of things. One, it gives you the necessary bandwidth from a physical connection standpoint to make sure that those don't interfere with each other, but it also allows the subsystem device driver and multipathing the operating system level to help you out there as well. So that's the main reasoning for that. Typically, SAN best practices say you'll have 2 connections to 2 separate fabrics. And so that's hence why we say 2-to-1. Right now, we can't dual attach tape drives, and I have some customers who do have dual SAN fabrics for tape, but I would say as a general rule that is a little bit too much redundancy. And the thing about your TSM servers, you need to maintain these physical disk to HBA ratios. That's one of the ways that you grow a system. As you add, that you would grow a system. The other piece that fits into this, we'll talk about it later in the next session, is Ethernet. So right now, one of the quick things to kind of look at is to make sure that this ratio exists within your TSM subsystem. Now, the third point is clearly something that I've experienced as far as mirroring internally or externally. My reasoning for this has to do with it just depends on what you have more faith in. If you have more faith in your internal disk, then you can mirror a copy internally so that no matter what, either you'd be able to come back up on that internal version or you'd be able to use that internal version of the database to restore your volumes on the SAN if they ever became unavailable or if they just became unavailable. couple of things to keep in mind. TSM writes to the database volumes in order of creation, so it does or would matter where you would create those volumes because that would also affect performance. And then for those of you, just a small little reminder, is always remember to remove that default TSM database volume that's created. Again, a lot of you in going through and looking at servers, looking at and evaluating their setups, this is always something really neat to kind of check for to make sure that that volume no longer exists because that can hurt performance as well, mainly because it's either going to be sitting on the C drive or it's going to be sitting on a root volume group, and having IO hit that particular volume is just not the best thing from a performance standpoint. And then lastly on this page, the whole idea here by giving you this RAID overview and understanding of file system and how the TSM database writes to all that is that you want to align all of these three factors so that the TSM database can write as it's writing, it can utilize the disk subsystem as efficiently as possible. Slide 29. We talk about what types of physical disks for the TSM database. Again, this is a preference thing, but in some senses it's not so much preference as it is what's available in your environment. And when I say low to mid-tier, I'm really saying DS4000 and even some of the newer DS5000 boxes that you have. Again, we look at high-tier subsystems. Typically, for those of you who have an embarrassment of riches in your environment, having a DS8000 with a couple of megapacks laying around is a nice way to have your, a nice place to have your TSM database, but some of us aren't necessarily that fortunate. One of the things to keep in mind, though, with these high-tier subsystems is that they do cache a lot of their I.O., and there are trade-offs for that. When TSM is writing, when TSM writes to these subsystems that have a lot of cache, it does take up space, and that could affect potentially performance for other loads that are running on that box that are cache-friendly. So it's something to consider. It's fine, but the thing to keep in mind here is that performance for the other applications could suffer as a result. Slide 30. Again, I repeat my admonition of not using hardware-level mirroring for fiber channel disk. And I even go so far to say, as always, use RAID TSM. Again, now that we're transitioning into the next version of TSM, there are some planning things that need to be thought out. Again, this is a good time. This is a good time to ask for additional disks to make sure you have these levels of protection built into your solution. Slide 31. I think it's pretty clear what I'm trying to say there. Do not use Ethernet attached storage for anything. When I say Ethernet attached storage, in particular, I'm talking about NAS. NAS, NFS, any of that sort of stuff. I know in some environments you don't have much of a choice, and I understand that. But it's really just from a performance standpoint, you shouldn't be using network attached storage for your database. Now, for other things that, again, depends on your environment, I've just found that this doesn't work nearly as well as it should, in part because the way that local area networks are managed versus storage area networks are managed are much different. Thankfully, TSM has safeguards in it to help you against corruption, but again, rather not take that chance. I'd rather see you guys run an internal disk first before you decide to go to network attached. Slide 32. We talk about virtualized subsystems, and in particular, one like SVC can help TSM immensely in terms of providing striped VDisk, which could increase performance. However, one of the things with our SVC solution is that a part of what makes it so good in terms of performance is the cache. But, and that cache is used for things like fiber channel, metro mirror, and global mirror, key functions for that storage subsystem to perform for the environment to be up. TSM has the tendency, however, to be very cache-friendly, and it being a cache-friendly load means that it can take up an exorbitant amount of the existing FEC cache, which can then lead to performance problems for other applications. So if you have virtualized storage that utilizes cache, like the SAN volume controller, you want to make sure that the VDES that you use for the database are created as cache-disabled VDES. And essentially all that means is that the writes for those VDIS will pass through the cache and go directly to the disk. Now, you're probably sitting there thinking, well, hey, that's what I want. And yes, you do, because you want this information to get passed as quickly as possible and written out to the physical disk as possible. That's the other reason why you want to make your logical volume configuration as simple as possible as well. Slide 33 brings us back to the agenda. So now we'll move into some more specific TSM information. Within slide 34, we'll talk again a little bit more about how the TSM database reads and writes. We'll talk about the TSM database and TSM recovery log. Again, this section is an attempt to sort of tie together all the things that we've talked about so far today and hopefully get everyone to a clear understanding of what's important in trying to make your database performance as good as possible. So the TSM database writes, on slide 35, writes transactions in 4K chunks to the recovery log in sequential order. And at a certain point, determined by your log mode, as well as other TSM parameters like transaction byte limit on the client side, as well as transaction group max and several other things that we as TSM folks have dealt with for years, will determine how these transactions, the amount of these transactions, and how they're written to the database. And then, of course, when they're written to the database, these writes happen in a random sort of order. It's random because when you take one file and when you take the information for one file, there's several different places where data has to be written to describe where that file is. And so when you think about all the different tables in the TSM database, you think about from a file perspective where are all the different places you have to write a piece of information to describe what you just backed up. It helps you to understand why the IO for the database is random versus what's going on in the recovery log is sequential. Slide 36, and here again, this is my own personal experience. This is what I've worked through in terms of my background of being a Unix system engineer at EDS for State Farm, where I've worked in some of the largest TSM implementations in the world, and they're still growing. And different calls that you may have been on look at this differently. I'm going to explain why I believe lots of smaller volumes are better, and it really has more to do with how AX as an operating system works and how it can make TSM work better. And so when we look at this, having more volumes, or having more database volumes, allows for AX as an operating system to assign more processes, more threads to the database. So for instance, for each database volume, there's a thread with an AX associated with it. And what happens is that when TSM gets a request for an operation, it'll schedule a concurrent operation for each database disk or database volume. So you can see at this point, you've got the operating system that will assign a thread to each of the volumes, but then also if TSM is issuing one concurrent write operation per volume, the more volumes you have, the more spread out your database is from a thread and IO operation standpoint, the more efficient TSM can be in finding information. That's what I've experienced, that you can use much more of the AX operating system than you may have in the past. And my experience, again, has been that TSM will use as much of the AX operating system and the physical hardware you give it. Some of it by default uses a great deal of it, but there are ways where you can allow it or set it up to use even more. In addition to that, TSM rate is enhanced because you have one thread per database volume, so it allows TSM to respond quicker to IO requests. And by default, TSM RAID, whether it's a mirror copy or an individual, whether it's a mirror copy or not, it's intelligent enough to know which volume is going to respond to it quickest in terms of retrieving information. Slide 38. Again, just some things we want to make sure we have all of our I's dotted and T's crossed in terms of some obvious things with TSM. Again, the mirrors need to be on different disks just because of the nature of the database, that it's a high IO type situation. They need to be on different physical disks. In the case of a disk subsystem, we are talking separate physical RAID arrays or LUNs or however you want to speak to those. Now, it's also possible to mirror three ways, as well as two ways. Again, I say three-way because you're at a time now where hopefully this would be something you'd be able to ask for and get because of the transition going to one version of TSM to another. And the thing to keep in mind is that's why you take some time to plan this out so that you can, one, plan this out and ask for those types of resources. And of course, if you always ask for the moon and you just get the stars, fine. You ask for three. If they can only give you two, you're in a good spot. So at the very least, do mirror. But if you can get enough space to do three mirrors, that would be great as well. And then today, most of us don't have databases larger than 500 gig. It's only 1.5 terabytes. It's really not that much data at the end of the day. But I'll leave that to you guys and gals to spin. Slide 39. Database backup and expired inventory are very CPU intensive. Part of that is just you've got a database, it's running, it's trying to find information and do different things with it. Makes a lot of sense. The thing is that we talk about a TSM database, and one of the questions I've always gotten is how big should it be? And so there's two things. One, there's the theoretical limit, which I'm sure most of you are saying, oh, Brandon, that's 535 gig. That's a theoretical limit. The largest I've ever seen with my own two eyes was 500 gig, so I do know they exist out there, and I've seen a bunch of 300s and 200s. But when asked that question by customers, typically I've approached it from a different perspective, not in terms of an absolute size, but things as mentioned under the second point. For instance, that your expire inventory, if you're going to run it every day, should finish before your daily database backups. Database backups shouldn't take longer than an hour. Now, I say that because I'm thinking in the context of your daily cycle and how long it takes to get things done. For some of you, you may not have to allow 2 hours for that, but I'm hoping at the end of this presentation, and from this information, you might find a way to get it back within that 1 hour. And then the last point, we talk about the restore process. Again, I'm thinking about the DR clock in terms of how long it's going to take you to recover your database, an hour and a half or so. A lot of that's going to be dependent upon the type and size of database that you have, but I can tell you that in the most recent DI exercise I participated in, we had a 150-gig database that was running on a DS8100. And let's just say that database restored in about 45 minutes. Now, we can talk specifically about how that was set up. If you want to know about that, you can send me an email. We can talk about it further, but for the most part, a lot of you, I'm figuring, are somewhere in that 100, 150 gig range. And so being within an hour, hour and a half is well within your capability. But again, if you're not there, I'm hoping that through this presentation you'll be able to figure out how to get there. Slide 40. So how do you verify if your database is running well? Well, some of you have seen these, you've seen these select statements before. And so the objects and how they're written to the database correspond with how TSM writes stuff to the database. And so what you would be able to do is once you have aligned the TSM writes all the way back down to the RAID array, essentially you'd be able to understand how long it takes or get an idea how long it takes for a single object within TSM to be written or read from the database using these particular scripts. So the whole idea here is to help you understand the page size and how they're written and being able to express your database in terms of numbers of pages and the size of those, and then being able to track how fast your expiration and database backups occur. The key here is that these are scripts that can help you establish a baseline for your current TSM database performance, and then as you make these changes that we suggest, you'll be able to say, okay, with this particular change, we're able to increase our ability to either the speed and responsiveness of our TSM database backup because our expirations and our database backups are happening quicker. And so with slide 41, the actual size of the database is going to depend on how fast, and I have fast with quotes around it, at least here. It's not there in the presentation, but I'm doing it, for how fast your hosting server is and how good your disks are and what service levels you need to provide. Service levels being how quickly does this database need to be gotten up in terms of a DR recovery, for instance, or in a total failure on production. And so, again, the proper disk layout and configuration at the hardware level can improve this behavior. The third step is something that I've just used as a rule of thumb when people ask for an absolute sizing or size of the TSM database. Now, I take a different approach to sizing TSM databases. I know some of you have your own sizing spreadsheets in the various different red books that have been created for TSM. There are spreadsheets that help you size and determine how big a TSM server database is going to be. My philosophy and what I've proven out with customers is that whatever you size it for right now, once you figure out what that is, it's already old. So in some situations, it's better, in my mind, to set up the hardware to be as fast as possible, even though it may mean that they'll have a 200-gig database. I mean, you can create a 200-gig database but not allocate 200 gigs of space. Again, the idea here is that you want to set up the system for performance. Now, in most resource-challenged environments, they've not had a whole bunch of disks to give. So this third point just says the database should be somewhere around, 2 to 250 gig. And that's really just a statement, too. When you start thinking about aligning database writes and reads to how things are physically laid out or written to the physical disk from RAID or the RAID constructs, to get performance, you're going to need more disk. For those of you who have been DBAs or understand how DBAs like things, it's the whole idea of I need spindles. And this really just says that you need spindles in order to get real performance out of the database. But for the most part, most people, a large majority of the customers have databases that are 250 gig and less. And you'd be able to achieve that type of capacity using two 146-gig disks. Obviously, with TSM 6, certain things change, but for right now, we're just going to focus on what you have in current environments. Slide 42, sometime after TSM 5.2, this command was actually put into database. So when running this, this is another way to figure out performance of your database, and it's also a good way to perform an impromptu DR recovery by using restore database copy. And then, of course, if you use a TSM database snapshot, it allows you to do this while on site and not have to take or utilize your offsite copy. And then this is also a good way to verify how your new disk layout will perform after you've established baselines using database backup and the expiration scripts in the aforementioned slide. The other thing that you can do with those scripts is you can, and I'll mention this later, but I'll mention it now that I'm thinking about it. You can take those scripts and create an operational reporting report for you that will do this automatically for you every day so that you can track it and establish baselines for yourself. Now, for the older TSM databases, there's different query DB commands that you can use on older instances. My hope is that not a lot of you are running older instances, and I understand there are certain situations where you have to. That's all understandable. But if you are, obviously there's other steps that you have to think about before you actually move into going to 6 in terms of getting your code level to a point where you can actually migrate into 6. And most of those issues have been covered by several other presentations, so we won't belabor that point. So for slide 44, I've even included a script here that can help you understand how much space could be reclaimed by unload and reload. Again, you also want to consider some other things here. Again, if you have the time, if you're able to get your database performing much better, and one of the things to keep in mind is that a second step is once you get your database, a part of this restoring your database to a test server, not only can you use the 5.5 code to get it in order, you can also test the upgrade procedure with 6.1 to also give you an idea. But this talks about other ways that you can clean up your database. If you haven't done an unload or reload, again, take some time, get this test environment, get a test environment set up, go through the process of trying to do something like this, because at some point you're going to have to clean up what's going on, and the last thing you want to do is have that prevent you from being able to move to TSM6 or upgrade your database quicker. And again, to point out, if you have a high percent underscore frag, that could indicate problems. And really, it's just problems in terms of that lets you know, okay, we've got some work to do in terms of getting our database in good health so that it can be migrated quickly. And then, like I mentioned before, you want to use the expiration and database backup scripts to monitor database performance, and you can do that through operational reporting. Okay, so now at the agenda point, we're at the server hardware overview, and at this time, we're going to open up for 10 minutes worth of questions. So, moderator?
Thank you. Today's question and answer session will be conducted electronically. If you'd like to ask a question, you may do so by pressing the star key followed by the digit 1 on your touchtone telephone. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, it is star 1 if you have a question or comment. We'll take our first question today from Ron Henghouse.
Yes, hi, Brandon. Got a question about what you were discussing on the database up to this point. You were talking about using mirroring, TSM's mirroring of the database. That obviously applied to version 5 and earlier releases. But with version 6, that's no longer supported. So I guess what you were describing was for the version 5 customers, correct?
Everything that I'm talking about is for version 5. And the reason for this is that everybody kind of needs to just level set their environment. I know that going into 6, there's some things that won't be supported initially or right away, if at all. But when we talk about improving the performance in their environments currently, it may be some time before they're actually they're allowed to make this sort of transition. And Ron, I'm sure you're familiar with, as many of us are, a lot of these database things can be done while the actual database is up. But to answer your question, and the question was, this applies, the mirroring such, the RAID TSM that I referred to applies to version 5 only. At this point, yes, because we're trying to get everybody ready and get their database cleaned up, get it on the best possible performing disk before they move into TSM6. So sorry for the long-winded answer, but yes, this is version 5 only.
Right, and the same would apply to raw logical volumes, correct?
Right, it would, because the raw logical volumes, again, they're going to be presented from the disk subsystem, So the same things in terms of IL and data strips and stripes would apply there because you're creating, that's created on the hardware subsystem for disk. And then when that's created, it gets presented to the operating system as a raw logical volume. And so even with raw logical volumes, everything that I've talked about applies because this is all talking about disk subsystem creation. And so I want to arm everyone with as much information as possible about the different subsystems that affect TSM so that they can speak intelligently to the storage administrators about how you need things set up, because it will be very key that you can talk to them in their language when creating these new volumes that you will then migrate your current TSM implementations to.
Right, but in discussing with customers, the implementers would need to explain that the raw logical volumes are available with version 5 but not available with version 6. So if someone's not currently using raw logical volumes, I'm not sure it would be a good idea to recommend that they implement that as part of preparation for going to version 6. Does that make sense?
It does. As you'll know, a lot of this, since most of this information is version 5 specific, and in particular, raw logical volumes was used only as a DR, as an option for DR. Now, what I will tell you, Brian, is that specific to DB2 and how DB2 does things, that's a separate project that I'm working on to go to in updating some of these particular things. My point is that there are a lot of people who aren't going to get to version 6 anytime soon, and a lot of people are going to have DR tests between now and that particular point. And so a lot of these proven practices are out there, but it's just, it's a good exercise to take yourself through. But there's another set of considerations for version 6, and I'm working on a presentation that speaks to those as well, because DB2 is a totally different animal altogether, as we all know.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Ron.
Next we'll hear from Bruce Harvey.
Yes, and Brandon, thank you very much. You mentioned at one point, and actually at several points in trying to reduce the number of buffers, reduce the latency of the data, as it were, through the process, you mentioned the use of direct I.O. in the file system, specifically of AIX, although there are other file systems that can use it. Would you also recommend the use of concurrent I.O., which not only reduces, eliminates the buffer, but also eliminates the locks on the inodes and actually speeds up processing as well, with the assumption being that TSM will take control of that and no one else should be touching it anyway? What about concurrent I.O.?
Concurrent I.O. I haven't had nearly as much success with, because when we think about concurrent I.O., TSM also has an asynchronous I.O. parameter that it has available too, which I don't use either. So what I've done is that no concurrent I.O. to be used, no asynchronous I.O., but because you have TSM doing its RAID TSM thing, because you also have, depending on how you have your subsystem, your multipathing driver set up, as well, that gives you more benefit than using operating system concurrent I.O. So I try, my thing here is that I'm trying to take the logical volume piece at the operating system out of this as much as possible and just letting the hardware and TSM, just getting them as close together. So I do not recommend concurrent I.O.
Okay. Thank you.
In my experience, I haven't had as much bang for buck with that as opposed to just making sure the multipathing was right and I had TSM running correctly.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Once again, it is star one if you have a question or comment. And, Mr. Moore, there are no further questions. Actually, we do have a question from Mujan Tulubadi.
Tulubadi. That's Mujan. Thank you. Hey, Brandon, thank you very much for your time. I had a couple of questions. One thing you mentioned about raw logical volumes or raw disk in Windows. I was aware of NTFS and FAT, but I wasn't aware of any RAW. How do you do RAW in Windows?
You'd have to have a logical volume manager in place. And so, in a way, I sort of contradicted myself because raw logical volumes, when you think about trying to set up a TSM server and you want to make it, one, as simple as possible and get it up and function as quickly as possible, to add in, say, an additional logical volume manager like Veritas Volume Manager, it just adds an additional level of overhead that you really don't need for what TSM does.
Right.
So, but for those people who have it in their environments and they use it, then when I speak of raw logical volumes, I'm talking of those that come from a volume manager like Veritas Volume Manager or Foundation Suite. Does that make sense?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Right.
And the other question was you mentioned in one of your slides about the disk HBA to tape HBA ratio of 2:1. I was wondering if that's maybe a little bit too general, because we need to understand what's the throughput or what's the I/O or capabilities that are on the disk subsystem, and maybe size the HBA ratio accordingly based on number of tape drives, the type of tape drive, and everything else. And that 2:1 might not always work.
Okay, so the question was, it basically had to do considering throughput from each side of that equation. How, with your 2:1 disk to tape ratio, how does that work? What I'm going to tell you is that I'm going to answer that question in a little bit more depth in our next section, but the idea is really based more on what best practices are for physical infrastructure in a SAN than it is, per se, throughput. But what I'll have you know is that there's another piece of this that we've not looked at. We're going to look at it in the next section that will drive through why you will have two HBAs, because typically you're going to have one HBA going to one fabric and one going to another. And then the other idea is that most people don't have redundant tape fabrics. So typically you only have one connection out to the tape drives, and most tape drives don't have two connections off of the back of them either.
Correct. And we have, well, basically in some majority of the accounts I work with, we use the Jaguars, which dual ported, and we have goes to both dual fabric, and then we need at least a 2x2 configuration in those environments.
Right. And no, and in that situation, one of the comments that I made is I do have customers that have dual, and that's fine. But at the very least, in some situations, what you have is, in fact, one of the questions I've got, you've got people who have their tape port, their tape HBA port to tape drive ratio seriously out of whack.
Exactly. We see that all the time.
Right. And so that's what the next section we're going to talk a little bit more about that. But I was looking at it that typically SAN best practices are going to dictate that you have a 2:1 because of how SAN administrators like to physically create the subsystem. You may have a situation, though, and 2:1 is a performance configuration. Sure, you can still have 2:1 and have 60 tape drives off the back end, but, you know, are you going to be able – how much data is actually going to move from the disk into the tape in that standpoint, and how many tape drives are you actually going to be able to drive?
Exactly, because, I mean, you need to understand how much you're able, how much your disk subsystem is allowed to, is able to feed to you, and how much you're able to write on the other side. So, and then in the middle of it, how much CPU power you have to push all that I/O.
Right, and so...
I mean, it becomes a balancing act, which we deal with customers all the time, so.
Correct, and it's what I call, it's my game that I play with the customers called finding the bottleneck, but do this for me. We're going to go through the next section. If I haven't answered your question or addressed it after the next section, there'll be time after for additional questions, and we can actually get into that because it's a really good point that you brought up.
And the last one, I promise this is the last one.
We have time. Go ahead.
Basically, we talked about TSM database and many smaller volumes and disk underneath the covers will give you better performance. Is that going to carry over to DB2?
Okay. That right now what I can tell you is that DB2, I don't have a real answer for that. I don't want to give you what I'm thinking right now, but DB2's internal structures, there's more to it than just what we have. I mean, if any of you who are familiar with DB2, the whole concept of containers and the way that it does things is different. So as I mentioned earlier before, I'm working on another paper or another presentation that speaks specifically to DB2 and how it handles IO. And again, that presentation will be more the DB2 stuff that we need to kind of understand, and really we'll go through it so that we understand how to set up the back-end disk subsystem and then be able to take that information and not get to the point where we're being DB2 admins, but within TSM in the context of how TSM is set up, try to minimize getting into DB2 as much as possible. Because a lot of this stuff can be taken care of at the hardware subsystem level. You just have to know the right things to say and the right things to do, right?
Exactly.
And again, if you're a software IT specialist, some of this stuff you just don't deal with every day. So I felt like there was a need for us to have something in the way of connecting the dots between software and hardware, and that's why I've kind of laid out these things. And trust me, I understand with each customer, things are going to be different. But with specifically about DB2, how will what I'm talking about here translates into it, the answer is I don't know yet because I'm still working through that paper.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
And Mr. Moore, there are no further questions.
Okay. So now we're going to move on to slide 46. Now, the title of this is The Server Hardware Overview. It contains excerpts from a presentation I gave at Software University in 2006. And before we got on the call, about 2 minutes before, they said there was about 60, 65 people on the call. And if I remember back to 2006, there weren't that many people in my room. It was a late-in-the-day kind of presentation, so, you know, deep stuff like this might have been a bit too much. So most of you have probably not seen this, but it is still out there on W3, and it should still be out there in Partner World. It's not the full presentation, but you have the session number 2678. You should be able to go back and take a look at that if you have any additional questions, because there's a piece there that I put in that's in that presentation but not in this one that talks about a performance expectation model. And with the last gentleman's question, it talks about how, from a physical standpoint, what things you need to have in place on the LAN side, on the HBA fiber channel side, and tape side, also giving consideration to anything LAN-free that you have to do as well. Okay. We'll touch on it a little bit here in terms of the general concepts, but the specific performance expectation model, what I've done in the latter section of the presentation is taken all of that stuff and said, okay, I'm just going to tell you what machines you need to use and here are the configurations so that it just demystifies this whole thing for you. It's good to kind of understand and see where everything was derived from. I mean, that was one of the things we all probably went through in our various technical classes. You know, in calculus, they took us through all this derivation. And then at the end, they showed this two-step method to get something. So that background information is available in session 2678. It's out there still on the web, but I wanted to cover some basic concepts here to fit into why I've created these hardware reference models. Slide 47. So this is the abstract from the particular presentation, and it seems eerily similar to here, but I wanted to make sure that I give you some background on as to why this stuff is important. Slide 48. So this subject should be important to you because, again, server hardware can be the most important piece of the solution, and proper server hardware will ensure the success of our proposed solution. And, of course, because there's software and hardware involved, obviously, SOSWAS, or sell our stuff with our stuff, is one of the tenets of how IBM tries to sell. And I know right now that I've sold millions of dollars of P-Series and disk subsystems with some of the TSM solutions that I've created. So you can really make friends with your storage hardware brethren by understanding their world, a little bit more. On slide 49, we want to talk about PCI. A lot of this stuff, you've seen some of these things, but it's important to give you a background on what PCI is. And really, it's just an interconnection technology used within computers. And so we want to understand, well, why does it matter? On slide 50, Obviously, PCI is a standard. It's created by the PCI Special Interest Group, and it talks about what it was chartered to do. Essentially, PCI just managing the development of this interface for IO transit. Slide 51. So, again, this is, I took this from the presentation unmodified in 2006. So, when we talk about these current standards, this is still valid, although there may be some changes. So, if some of the stuff seems a bit outdated, I'll try to point those out. But, again, I lifted it directly from my 2006 presentation. So, we all know about PCIX, but and we definitely all know about PCI Express. If some of you who have home computers at home and you're gamers, I mean, PCI Express has made your world a whole lot funner and easier in terms of having higher pixel per second rates. And again, at the time, PCIe was a newly emerging standard, and it was named initially at the Intel platforms. Now, slide 52 is a really good chart. It's a good chart because in the presentation of 2006, I went into at that time why some of the machines weren't performing as well. And I wanted to have some backup information as to why we had different sort of benchmarks for assuming performance. For a long time, there was a thought that you could only get 40% efficiency out of a network adapter. And I know that if you go back to some of the earlier red books and red papers that was created, you saw that a lot where it just said 40% efficiency. A great deal of that had to do with the actual code that runs the PCI bus. And so part of this whole process of modernizing it, the actual code that runs the bus has been updated. So in some of your earlier implementations of TSM, you would have found that if you look on the left, that you would have gotten maybe 50% efficiency out of a given slot, which then translates into less than 50% overall throughput for a given card that's put into that slot. One of the things that's happened, obviously, with the improvement of the code and the standard is that efficiency has been raised significantly. So if you look on the right-hand side, you see that with PCIX in particular, that actual user data represented by the yellow piece, the efficiency of that has been raised significantly. So that's one of the things that I wanted to point out to people as to why you've seen some of the rules of thumb for sizing things. It's been because of the code that actually runs the bus for the card. Now, that's stuff that's internal. Things outside of the network and how poorly or how good or bad the actual network itself is set up, that goes without saying. That's something that you can't necessarily control. If you look at making sure that the TSM server, the center of all this IO, can work as efficiently as possible, then looking at the external factors, which you can't necessarily control, it just helps you better understand how that works. On slide 53, we talk about PCI Express and some of its.
Hello, Mr. Scott. My same time froze, so I was like, I can't respond.
Okay. We have someone that needs to go on mute still. And so with PCI Express, what we have is just some characteristics that are different. And on slide 54, we actually compare PCI Express to PCIX. The biggest thing here is that PCIX was a shared, in some situations, a shared or a parallel bus technology, which meant for every single clock sweep, it would go through every single particular slot on the bus. And from a performance standpoint, it's not nearly as efficient as PCI Express is in that everyone has their own bus and they can send things whenever they're ready to and they don't have to wait for an IO cycle to come through. We take this comparison a step further on slide 55 and give you a chart that helps you understand how the IO technologies and the IO applications, in this case IO applications being Ethernet and fiber channel, would apply to a given slot. And so it's this chart that I've used tons and tons of times, and also it was part of the basis for helping me develop these performance expectation models. Again, if you know what the buses are, you know what slots or how many cards can go in a particular bus. And obviously when you have a shared bus, depending on how many slots are on that shared bus, it would have divided by some factor, being the factor being the number of slots on that bus, your throughput. And so even here, if you were to take, say, a 4-gigabit fiber channel at 0.8 gigabytes per second, the thing there to keep in mind is that if it's a dual port card, obviously it would be 0.8 times 2. And then if it's 0.8 times 2, it's 1.6, which means that it must be in a PCI Express slot of at least a by 4 or a PCIX 266 megahertz. One of the things also is that it was important to pay attention to the red papers for each of the AX and System X boxes because they give you these wonderful motherboard diagrams to help you understand the differences in their back-end architecture. And what we found is that in 2006, the X 260, 460s, and the 366 boxes had PCIX buses, but they had their own slots, their own individual slots, so they weren't on shared buses. One of the examples I had in the presentation detailed an HP server that was a really popular server that you saw in data centers that happened to be a part of that happened to be used for TSM servers for some of my customers, and there were shared buses, and they were wondering why they were getting performance problems. So wanted to bring this point this out to you because this can be very useful in looking at existing environments and helping, at least at the very low levels of hardware infrastructure, understand what's going on with a given client. And so slide 56 really talks about some of the current design standards. Again, at the time, there was a huge push within the Intel space to make PCI Express very prevalent. A lot of the gaming industry drove that. What you did see, however, is a subsequent exchange on the Unix world. And so here we just talked about what the various different lane sizes were and had been used for. And the thing to keep in mind is that when I first gave this presentation, I said over the next 12 to 36 months, you're going to see this migration or this change within IO subsystems. We're now 36 months out from that, and PCI Express is everywhere, including in P-Series boxes, Solaris boxes, HPUXs, and various others. So now we're on slide 57. So out of all that, and that original presentation was about 60 slides itself as well, out of all that, what I did is we had created a performance expectation model. And that was designed around a couple of concepts that we're going to go through in the next couple of slides. So in slide 58, I tried to take the guesswork out of sizing TSM servers. I tried. At the very least, this information, the sharing of it in this forum, will help others kind of confirm a lot of things that they've always known. We put a lot of different things from different parts of IBM and just IT together to figure this stuff out. So I'm hoping that this is making things simple, but we'll see. It's made it simple for me. Second point is that Ether channel, or the concept of Ether channel, which is link aggregation or Ether channeling, or however you want to put it. Again, this is just the idea of taking Ethernet links and combining them together in a logical connection. So you take a two-port gigabit Ether channel, and so essentially you'd be able to theoretically double your throughput. Now, again, I have some customers who don't support Ether channel at all. I have a couple of customers who don't even do gigabit Ethernet. So in certain situations, you have different challenges, but Ether channel is a big part of creating this performance expectation model. Again, if they don't have LAN networks that support Ether channel, whether it's at the 100 megabit or 1,000 megabit level, there are other things that you have to do, and obviously LAN free would be one of those. With each of these platforms, they have enough NIC bandwidth on board without using a PCIe or PCIX slot. And we'll talk about that a little more when we get to those configurations. And then again, I put this here, and this really applies to the P-Series boxes. In some of the P-Series boxes, they still have PCIX slots, but the PCIX slots are on their own buses, but it's still PCIX technology. I would just rather put the tape drives on the PCI Express slots because, one, the PCI Express, depending on how your switches are configured, you just have more room for bandwidth growth there, because after 4 gigabit, there aren't going to be any 8 gigabit PCIX HBAs. So that's one of the reasons why you put disk there, because you're not going to see nearly as much throughput through the disk as you would, say, from tape to tape or back through to the tapes. But that's a whole other set of discussion as well. So in summary, on slide 59, this is what I've experienced with the performance expectation models, and it will be different for different people because the network that gets the data to the TSM server may not be able to sustain these levels of performance. So what I want you to understand is that on the front end from the LAN, with this given configuration, the box itself can process for AX up to 1,000 gigabytes. Hold on. 1,000 gigabytes per hour. That means that if, so that means you could have potentially one machine. Well, you probably have more than one machine, but in total, you could have 1,000 machines that do a gigabyte per hour connected into one machine. Okay. Now, most of you are probably scratching your heads a little bit on this, but I will tell you that when I worked for State Farm, I did, and this was an H50, that particular box, because of the amount of clients we had to back up, that box was able to sustain 500 simultaneous connections at one time. And the problem was that on that particular box, I had to get 3,000 clients backed up in an eight-hour period. Now, again, we're not talking about a high level of data. We're talking at the most maybe a gig or so per machine. But the whole idea is that the operating system has more to do with the number of connections that can be had than TSM does, because it's all IP. It's all in the way that the operating system is configured to handle IP. And when you think about certain web servers, depending on how they're configured, can handle up to 1,000 simultaneous connections again. So this comes back into how having some operating system experience and being able to understand how this application and the operating system interact helps you to understand that, hey, this is how much we could potentially do. Now, obviously, if you put a 4-port gigabit Ether channel together, their theoretical and even some of their actual output would be greater than 1,000 gigabytes per hour. And everything that I do in terms of sizing, I always build in some overhead, because whatever particular load you place in that box is going to grow. And so you don't want to fill the box up. And, again, these are things we all know, but you don't want to fill a box up to the brim because, again, the amount of data going to the box is going to increase. You want to leave some overhead so that you're not sitting there within a month or so, you're having to move machines off to another TSM server because you don't have any headroom. The key point here is that I know a lot of us have a love affair with the 550, you know, the H50 first, then the 550. The 550 has been a great box within System P. And I've been working on RS6000 since the mid-90s, and my first RS6000 box was an R30. So I've tracked the progress of this piece of hardware for quite some time. As we move into Power 6, what I was able to determine is that the 550 and the 520, in terms of their main unit, CEC, or computing electronic complex, are identical. So what happened is that when you price the two together, because of how the 550 is priced in terms of its requirements, the 520 really fits into a particular sweet spot. And, in fact, what I was able to do, and one of the things I taught myself how to use the hardware configurator to create configurations for my hardware buddies. That's also a valuable tool to have, so that when I send them over these configurations, it's exactly the way I know I need it to be for performance. What I found is that the 520 is just a better option from a price standpoint, and it gives you the same sort of performance. The other cool thing is that the 520, you can get the 4.2 gigahertz Power 6 processor. The price spread for the 4.2 520 and the 3.5 is where they overlap. If you go to a 4.2 and a 550, it puts the box in the upper 70s and 80s and 90s in terms of thousands of dollars, and you really, for some people, that starts getting out of their comfort zone for wanting to pay. The second bullet may surprise you. I did some testing for a customer in one of our IBM labs, and we were pleasantly surprised at how much data a Windows box properly configured could actually process. Now, again, aside from everyone's thoughts about Windows, I understand all of that. What I want you to understand, though, is that the hardware underlying a System X3650 now is the most capable it has ever been. And these boxes are really capable of moving a lot of I/O. If you don't believe me, if any of you have ever heard of SAS or Scale-Out File System, if you look at how they're building their SAS configurations, you're going to find that the X3650 is the box that is in the midst of all these. Now, I'd already settled on the X3650 quite some time ago, but if you have questions about how much data that box can move, all you have to know is that the GPFS and the Scale-Out File System guys base their solution on 3650 boxes. And in that solution, it requires you to move a lot of data. So not only have my own tests with customers proved it out, but even within IBM themselves, they're building solutions around this box. And again, from a price performance standpoint, the 3650 versus, say, a 3850, you just can't beat it. Now, I'm not going to get into recommending AX over Windows. All I will say is that the hardware underlying Intels has significantly improved with the addition of PCI Express. So the thing is there, it gives you flexibility when you have situations with maybe some customers who don't have any Unix or Linux in their environment at all. They have Windows boxes. They may like the X3650. This now becomes a viable option for them because of the underlying I/O subsystem. And then with the other vendors, I have created reference models for Sun, Solaris, and Dell, and HP, but let's just say that those could be made available by request. I want to make sure that we focus on selling our stuff with our stuff. Now, you guys on slide 60 have a PDF. And what I actually did was I created the actual configuration files from the Hardware Guys tool and placed them in the PowerPoint presentation that I have. Well, obviously, when I converted it to PDF, that wasn't a part of the picture. I apologize for that. So as the slide says, for those of you who want those, you can send me an email and I can send those out. One of the things that I said I want to try to do, that I'm going to do, is make this information available in a format that's much more friendly than email. And so we'll be working on developing that. But what these configurations represent are all of the ether channeling that I'm talking about, the 2-to-1 HBA ratios, all this stuff is expressed in a server configuration that you can take, you give to your storage hardware brethren, or if you're a business partner, your various different distributors, they can take that, and it's a retail price config. They can take that information, put it in. Of course, there's some specific things they would have to do for their customer in terms of power options, but for the most part, it's all there. And sort of to give you an idea of the price spread for these, because I did configurations with 10 gigabit Ethernet as well as 4 gigabit Ethernet, but you're looking at the high end for a 520 box retail, we're talking in the 60,000 range, if that, and that's one that has 8 gig HBAs and multiple 10 gig Ethernet parameters, but the 520s range between 38 and 60 retail, depending on the aisle configurations that you set up. And then for the 3650s, those configurations retail sit somewhere between 20 and 25, depending, again, on what aisle options that you select. But the idea here to make all of this simple is that after going through creating this performance expectation model, I found that one of the gaps that we just have is someone asked us, well, how do I size the hardware for this? And it was always I remember what I did last time, so I'll just copy this again. Well, sometimes just having this information available and just being able to send it over to your hardware guys, for me, has helped shorten the sales cycle process. It's also made things much easier for me to do. And what I've done is over time, as they release new models, I refresh this. And it really made my life a whole lot easier, because now that's one less call, or in some situations, one less call, one less email I have to answer from salespeople, because I can just tell them, okay, within 5 questions, I can say, all right, here's the box that they need to go get it, and not have to go through that sizing process again, because I know that these boxes can handle up to this amount of data. It just makes sense to fill them out rather than trying to come up with a different configuration every time. It's just helped me be more efficient. And so slide 61 was supposed to be the configurations themselves. And then in subsequent presentations, there's different considerations for hardware platforms. Some of those, including but not all of these, are VMware Consolidated Backup, SAP, PeopleSoft databases, cluster databases, large file servers. Just a comparison between 3050 and 3950, a lot of that is going to be cost, but as you start seeing customers getting into virtualization more, you're going to start seeing some really interesting things happening with 3850s, 3950s, and VMware Consolidated Backup. So it's another set of considerations to be made. And then additionally, where does a 550, 570, or even a 590 make sense? And that's actually a project I've worked on a couple of years where we've looked at the 570. Typically, when you do SAP or other application or ERP platforms, you'll typically put them on a big box and use virtualization. And getting into the issue of, do we have a TSM server outboard, or do we have one as an LPAR, and if so, how we configure it. For those of you who hadn't heard, from what I understand, at some point coming to a maintenance level update near you for AX, that the idea of having virtualized tape at the VIO level, virtual IO server level, is coming, if it's not already here. But I keep hearing that that's going to happen, and that's been one of the things that I'll just say my opinion on that is that I don't know if that's needed yet, because when you start talking about IO and moving data back and forth between the TSM server, it remains to be seen how valuable that particular piece of infrastructure will be to a TSM environment. Slide 63 covers a bunch of thanks and references on that page. Some of you who are on the call are probably on that page. Some of you, these are people that over my career have always been there for me, have encouraged me, have helped me with the benchmarking, as well as folks who I bounce different ideas from, and those people are combination of current IBMers, former IBMers, and business partners. And then the references, again, different people who provided me performance information, and then just where I've gotten some of the information for today's call. And then slide 64 will now move us into our questions section. And, again, the first question on your mind is that my daughter? And I will tell you, no, that's not my daughter in that picture. So, moderator. Moderator, are there any questions?
And it is star 1 if you have a question. As a reminder, that is star 1 if you have a question at this time. And Mr. Moore, there are no questions.
Well, thank you. This is Tricia Jong again. Thank you, everybody, for taking the time to join this call today. Please be looking out for the other calls that we will be having in the TSM6 series, where we'll have chalk talks with developers, we'll also have the pricing folks on. We'll be looking at some of the NDMP implementations and some of the other nice aspects of TSM6. So with that, I'd like to once again say thank you and remind you that this has been recorded. If there is anybody who'd like to replay it, it'll be posted out on Tivoli Talk section as well as on the Partner World. Thanks again.
Thank you. That does conclude today's conference call. We thank you for your participation and have a nice day.